last 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Cut, Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out, your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
It is Saturday the 12th, no, the 11th of April. It is Saturday the 11th of April in the glorious future year of 2026. And I just realized I forgot to close the window. Hold on a minute. Ah, all the things I could have forgotten. Nobody wants to hear the noise of the, conversation of people as they go down the street, or worse yet, cop cars doing their sirens. So, I'm actually going to begin with a little bit of housekeeping, which is to let you know about my travel plans. It never seems as though I get to stay in one place long enough to do anything useful. But I have, so I'll be in Helsinki on the 6th of June for a friend's birthday party. And then I am going to be assuming that the status quo ante continues in some form or fashion, flying back to the United States from Helsinki. And I will be in the U.S. just about 3 weeks, and then on the 27th, departing, 28th, arriving, I'll be back in Europe. Obviously, this assumes that I'm not arrested on sight when I reach the U.S. for loudly expressing my contempt for the head honcho and his goon squads, but that is, I guess, the one consolation that goes along with feeling as though nobody ever listens to the things I say. It's unlikely that I'll be stopped. That if they demand to see my Facebook or my Twitter, they're going to find out I don't have any. We shall see. Anyway, I also expect to spend some time in the back half of this month into the beginning of May in Britain. And I'm going to do several things while I'm there. It's not just a way to pad out my Schengen stay, although it is certainly that, rather like spending a year dead for tax purposes. I expect to go to York in order to lend my video cassette to the library at the National Railway Museum there, the video cassette A Day Out, which I've had digitized, which shows the extreme oddity of the excursion train to the Sellafield nuclear site pulled by the Flying Scotsman preserved steam locomotive. While I'm in that area, I'll probably go up to Steamtown, or whatever the devil they call it, the Railway Museum, which has near Darlington, which has the Flying Scotsman and several other preserved steam locomotives, just to see it. I'll also meet up with Stug, undoubtedly, both because he's a great guy and because he has some stuff that I had mailed to him with his permission. I have to be clear, because eBay's global shipping program likes to lose one-of-a-kind and valuable items. And so I'll be meeting up with Stug. Any other SDFers who'd like to meet up while I'm in Britain, I'm certainly open to it. But yeah, I'm thinking I'll spend some time in York, maybe some time in Blackpool, maybe some time in Bristol. We'll see. So yeah, that's a basic summary of my travel plans. It's entirely possible I'll be in Britain from around the 20th of April to around the 4th of May. Again, that's sort of how I'm trying to arrange my life. Then, during my brief stay in the U.S. in June, like I say, just under 3 weeks, I will probably spend the whole time turning that crate of copier paper I bought into copies of Blast 1 and 2. I am still very far from a finished Blast number 3, although it is entirely possible that during May I will make some headway on it. Now, what is the big news this week? Of course, it is NASA's Artemis II mission, which touched down, depending how you want to look at it, either yesterday or earlier today. It was after 0 hours UTC. And I had to stay up quite late to see the splashdown, and then I was not able to stay awake long enough to see the crew actually exit the capsule. But yeah, launched on the 1st of April into an Earth orbit, did orbit-raising maneuvers, exited into a free return trajectory, managed by a technicality to be the farthest away from Earth that humans have ever been, while the folks in the International Space Station, who happened to be on the far side of the Earth, with no view of the Moon at that time, managed to make themselves the farthest from another human that humans have ever been, which I thought was pretty good. And they used relay satellites to talk to each other. Because with relay satellites, you can see around the curve of the Earth, isn't that right? But aside from that, I suppose it's terrible because I should have been the person most excited by all this, and I couldn't. I just couldn't work up the enthusiasm that I should have had. And why? Well, I'm guessing it's a combination of a few things. The first is, you know, because the thing is, yeah, this isn't something that's happened in my lifetime, right? I was born after the initial space shuttle flight. I was born almost a decade after the last of the Apollo lunar missions, right? So this hasn't happened in my lifetime. I should be more excited about it. I genuinely should, and I just couldn't bring myself to be. And like I say, I think that comes down to a few things. One of them is, again, that this hasn't happened during my lifetime. We're having to start over, right? We have all this to do over again when we should have been doing it right along. If you told anybody in 1976 that in 2026 it would be, yeah, we've gone back to single-use rockets with ballistic capsules on top and sending somebody into a, you know, outside low Earth orbit is a big deal, they would have been appalled. And rightly so. You know, folks thought the space shuttle would work, right? Folks expected the space shuttle to work. And when the space shuttle worked, right, then lots and lots of people would be able to get into Earth orbit, and from Earth orbit, why, you're halfway to anywhere. Stepping stones, right? So there were lots of plans early on to use the orbital transfer vehicle upper stage for the space shuttle, which is a refuelable upper stage. The idea was the space shuttle would take it into orbit either along with a satellite or by itself. It would, at least in one incarnation, the very primitive incarnation of it was that the space shuttle would take it into orbit with the satellite attached, deploy it from the payload bay, it would boost the satellite into its target orbit, and then boost itself back and be picked up by the space shuttle and taken back to the ground for service. And refueling. And then later on, upgrades to the orbital transfer vehicle would allow it to stay in space and be refueled, right? And you'd get this escalation of capabilities. And you'd have a space shuttle which would serve as a depot for servicing spacecraft and refueling the orbital transfer vehicle, all that kind of thing. And we didn't get that. You know, NASA, well, space shuttle just didn't work as intended. It just wasn't as good as it was supposed to be. And so instead of 50 missions a year, right, a flight every week, one of five orbiters flying every, you know, flying 10 times a year, right, every 5 weeks. Anyway, Shuttle just couldn't do the things it was meant to do. And maybe it could have done them with uprates and upgrades, and it would have required a much higher level of national effort. Now, today, right, today it's different. And I don't think we have yet appreciated that difference properly. And partly it's because the people making that difference, some of them, not all of them, but some of them are going out of their way to make it as hard to appreciate as possible. Let me tell you what I mean by that. You know, you could never really buy a space shuttle flight. There was originally a plan for that, right? That was a pathway NASA hoped to be on, was to be a commercial operator, flying commercial payloads on a commercial basis, which never really happened. NASA did sell a few satellite launch spots, but they were mostly kind of experimental. The true National Space Transportation System never materialized as envisaged. And so American operators with, say, communication satellites wound up launching them either on expendable launch vehicles from the U.S. or expendable launch vehicles from some other country. After the late 1980s, really, that included Russia. Because they realized that, you know, their Proton was a big launch vehicle. It could handle those heavy satellites. All this kind of thing. Anyhow, if I seem morose and rambling, I guess to an extent I am. Right, because, as I said, we have all of it to do over again. But today, the thing is, there are true commercial providers, not only for rocket launches, but also for manned flights. And that may really be the more significant thing that NASA has done in the past 10 years, 15 years, right? Is that we now have, for example, SpaceX. Now, you can hate Elon Musk all you want to. You're probably perfectly entitled to do so, perfectly authorized to do so. But you can't deny that by dint of being willing to keep throwing money at engineers, even when all seemed lost, he brought a very important capability into the world. That's the key here, right? You know, if Elon Musk is an interesting phenomenon here because he illustrates some very important things, right? One is that if you're going to have very rich people in your society, they don't have to be useless parasites if you can find a way to motivate them to do things that nobody else is motivated to do. Because what SpaceX is doing now with refurbishment and reuse of what were used to be considered purely expendable boosters, very lightweight vertical launch rockets, right? What they are doing now is something that everybody in the field knew could be done at least as long ago as 1995. You got to thank G. Harry Stein for that, right? With the DCX program, when he took money which was intended for a paper study of reusable launch vehicles, and between his unparalleled contacts in the aerospace industry, because he was there at the beginning, and everybody who got into aerospace through high-power model rocketry virtually worshipped him as a god, right, because he was the father of that. You know, you want to say G. Harry Stein around anybody who knows what the word Tripoli means other than Libya. The thing is, and so allegedly he actually had an RL-10 engine in his garage, which really streamlined the process. But he demonstrated, you know, vertical takeoff and landing with liquid hydrogen fuel, right? The trickiest, most difficult to handle stuff in the world. People realize, well, if it can be done with that, then we can do it with oxygen, kerosene, easy peasy, pudding and pie. And that is what, you know, that is what Musk paid for. He kept throwing money at engineers because he believed them when they told him it could be done. Now, of course, now he's got sidetracked into at least two things, right? He couldn't leave well enough alone. He couldn't just keep letting them do what they do best. He had to say, oh, well, now you're doing that. We've got to do this Starship thing, which is, last time I looked, it was eating the company from the inside. I don't know. Maybe they're doing better now. And then the Starlink thing, which is as misbegotten as I can express. And I've said repeatedly that low-altitude comsat combinations are a dumb idea. Low-altitude comsat constellations assume that round-trip lag is the biggest problem you face. And right now, today, that's simply not true. Because the majority of internet traffic, right, the majority of data bandwidth is being used for what? Streaming media. Streaming media doesn't care if you need an extra quarter second of round trip time. The stuff buffers all to hell all the time. So it'd make much more sense than to have a couple of dozen at maximum gigawatt-scale geosynchronous constellations assembled in low orbit, right, from components brought up from Earth, then raised to high orbit using ion propulsion, than it does to have, they're talking about a million Starlink satellites and their close relatives in other people's low orbit constellations, satellites which have average lifetime of less than a year because of their low altitude, and the fact that being solar powered, of course, they've got a lot of drag, and so they just fall back down to the atmosphere all the time, and they're burning up in the atmosphere constantly, loading up the upper atmosphere with aluminium, which is bound to have interesting effects, at a minimum, on the heaviside layers. I genuinely do not know. It's very strange to me. Anyway, and of course you've got observational astronomers who are mad and sad and now hate space travel. That was a special one for me. So managed to get observational astronomers to hate space travel. I have to say, of course, I hew to the statement that anybody other than amateurs, and I will never put down amateur astronomy. Amateur astronomy is scientifically important, and it's important for other reasons. But anybody other than amateur astronomers should not be doing their observational astronomy from ground level, even if that ground level is the top of a mountain in Chile, because no matter how many fancy image processing tricks that you're able to use, right, to smooth out the distortions in the atmosphere, the plain fact is, firstly, the atmosphere does continue to blur your view of celestial objects, and secondly, it kills many wave bands of interest. You need to be in a low Earth orbit, in a medium Earth orbit, in a high Earth orbit, in a solar orbit, on the surface of an airless planetary body. We got one of those handy very close by. In fact, some folks went out and did a little look-see at it just the other day. You know, airless planetary bodies, very handy for this kind of thing. Anyway, so, you know, instead of having, people are talking about millions of low Earth orbit commsats. It's a stupid idea. And it's even more stupid in practice, because there is no fancy algorithm for getting them into orbits that don't collide. That would be a very interesting use of computing power. It would also be a very difficult use of computing power, believe it or not, because there's several things going on at any given time. The satellite in orbit is perturbed by a number of different phenomena. There's the non-spherical nature of the Earth and the uneven distribution of the mass within the Earth itself, which tugs on orbiting objects and tends to change the shape of their orbits. There's the atmospheric drag. Atmospheric drag is not constant. It is different in different locations around the Earth at any given moment, and it changes over time. For example, Skylab re-entered the Earth's atmosphere a year earlier than expected, thus completely killing any chance of a rescue mission with a space shuttle, partly because of solar weather, which inflated the outermost fringes of the atmosphere, increasing the drag. So, and then you've got solar tides, then you've got lunar tides. It is a very complex problem. You want to simulate thousands, tens of thousands, conceivably a million of these things, and check on whether they're going to whack into each other and give them commands to keep their orbits from intersecting. No, they don't actually do that. What they do is take updated tracking data periodically and do a brute force search for the ones that are most likely to whack into each other and just issue them commands to nudge out of each other's way. This has two problems. One is that you may be nudging it into the orbit of something else. The other is you use up your available maneuvering fuel faster that way. The whole thing is idiocy. I'm not clear that there is a good way to do this, but this certainly is not the good way of doing it. Now, I'm not saying that I did not experience any of what they're now calling moon joy, and I'm not saying that I'm not glad to see people who've been very down on space activities talking about billionaires, dick-waving contests, we've got trouble here on Earth. You know, there's folks saying, hey, wait, we didn't go to the moon for 50 years and it didn't solve any of our problems here on Earth. Maybe that whole business about, you know, we shouldn't go to the moon until we can solve our problems here on Earth is bullshit. Which it is, but I'd sort of given up on hearing too many people say that. So it is gratifying, right? It is gratifying, but it could be better. And the other thing is, of course, the turnip in chief and his constant war. He wants to kill. Guy sitting on the toilet at 2 in the morning, sending out communiques to the world via his own private communique system saying, "A great civilization dies tonight and will never rise again." I was legitimately concerned the guy was going to use nuclear weapons, and I'm still not convinced that he won't. This is not acceptable, all right? It's just not acceptable. Now, I'll say, right, to the people who say, we have to solve all our problems on Earth before we could go into space, or it's irresponsible, I'll say, look, what if the solutions, right, are outside? Do you really want to try to open the box with the crowbar that is inside it? Because you can do that. All you got to do is shake the box really hard. But that does tend to destroy anything else that's in the box. I was just confronted with the starkness, right, the starkness of our choices, once again, that with modern scientific technology, we can do things of enormous beauty, we can do things that increase freedom, that enhance and elevate the human spirit, and improve the conditions of human life. Or we can use them to brutally murder and slaughter each other, tear the flesh from each other's bones, leave each other just piles of rags. I have a very strong moral preference, okay? And the people in the U.S. government right now are, well, they're putting a lot less effort into the things that elevate and uplift and improve than they are into the destroying part. I can't stand that. Jared Isaacman, look, I'm not going to say that Jared Isaacman is a bad person for taking the NASA administrator position. I would not take any position with this U.S. government. Even that one. But certainly it would be strongly tempt me. That's about it. Now, that's about all I can say, right? Is that certainly the best people in the U.S., you know, if I were in the U.S. Navy right now, which thank God I am not, the only place I would want to be is aboard the recovery ship, right, with a space capsule. I sure would not want to be out there somewhere sinking Iranian ships, which, as I've mentioned, is technically an act of piracy. I know that's a strange thought, but it is, since there has been no declaration of war, because only Congress can declare war. Anyway, if I were in the Navy, I would want to be on the USS John Murtha and not anywhere else, because that's something people can be proud of. But really, that's what it is, that we have before us stark choices. And these are not new. Life to one side of you, death to the other. That goes back to the biblical times, goes back to the Bronze Age. Beating swords into plowshares, that one goes back into the Bronze Age too. Anybody who complains about nuclear energy being a dual-use technology, friend, all technologies pretty much are dual use. And even if every civilian nuclear installation in the world were to shut down tomorrow, it would not mean one nuclear weapon the less to menace the world. So let's get the best use out of these missiles and these nuclear reactions that we possibly can. The use that will make life better for humanity, that elevates the spirit, that enriches the mind. Why not?